This is another iRaw podcast.
For me, the biosecurity major actually started in the 1960s when the United States tried to transform Taiwan into a global meat factory.
Just like that, we are on episode 7 of season 5. Can you believe it? So in the season, as you already know, we are focusing in on animals and biosecurity. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about the politics of domestication. And this leads quite nicely, I think, from some of the conversations we've had so far. I'm especially thinking about some of what we spoke about with Camille in the last episode, as well as Thomas in the one before. And in this episode, we're paying particular attention to some of the global political links that make up the agri-food industry. We spend a lot of time in this episode discussing factory farms in Asia and how they've undergone dramatic changes in response to historical geopolitical events. My guest today is Chi Mao Wang, an assistant professor at the Department of Bioindustry Communication and Development at the National Taiwan University. His research interests include food geographies and more than human geographies, and he is currently undertaking research on animal geographies and food politics in East Asia, with particular attention to the management of animal life through modern scientific knowledge. We spend a large portion of the interview discussing his recent paper titled Securing Participation in Global Pork Production Networks, Biosecurity, Multispecies Entanglements, and the Politics of Domestication Practices. We cover a lot of ground in the interview, but I was particularly taken by some of what he said in the latter parts of our conversation, where Chi Mao discusses how biosecurity measures are not only seeing an erosion of indigenous practices, but that to achieve situations in which the threat of pathogens is reduced, it's going to require a separation of the practices of eating meat from ideas of progress and civilization. We also talk a lot about pigs in today's episode and some of the different ways in which different species or breeds of pigs are treated in the industry, and I found that really quite fascinating. But let me not ruin it for you. And as always, thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Chi Mao. Welcome to the Animal Tone podcast.
My pleasure.
It's so great to have you on the show. I read your paper a little while ago where you were speaking about the politics of domestication and a global agri-food industry. And I thought that it would be really interesting to talk to you about some of these dynamics, because as you know, we're doing a season on animals and biosecurity. And a really important part of biosecurity is actually the globalization of agriculture and, of course, what it means to be domesticated. So I'm really happy to have you on the show today. But before we get into kind of talking about the concept and these ideas, I want to get to know you a little bit first. So could you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to be interested in animals and biosecurity?
Thank you so much for having me, Claudia. I'm so pleased to be here. My name is Chi Mao Wang. I was born and raised in the Taiwanese countryside, where farmers keep a variety of animals, such as pigs, geese, ducks, and so on. So I'm a rural geographer and a sociologist who is interested in rural development. I could still remember when I was young, I could visit any animal farm wherever I want. However, in 2018, I have an opportunity to visit a pig farm. It is the time before the COVID-19 pandemic. I noticed that before entering a pig farm, I need to wear a medical mask, shoes, and so on, which are called personal protective equipment, also called PPE. Now, I know this term becomes so quite popular and well-known before the COVID-19 pandemic. During that time, I was surprised by these biosecurity measures and developed a research interest in farm animals since then, because when I was young, I don't need to wear this kind of PPE equipment before entering a pig farm, but now I need to do that. I'm interested. Why we need to do that? They are just animal, and why we need to wear this kind of protective equipment before we have contact with this animal. So that's the start of my research interest.
Wow. So when you were a child, you said you grew up in a rural area and animals were just quite visible to you. There were animals in many places and you could just see the animals in farms and in people's homes. So that's quite different to, you know, I grew up in Johannesburg and there were animals everywhere. Like I'm from South Africa, but I grew up in a big city. So I didn't really see animals. I didn't see pigs or cows or chickens at all really when I grew up. So this kind of observation is different for me. I thought about it as being rural. So that makes me think, in Taiwanese cities, when you were growing up, would you also come across animals in Taiwanese cities? Or has this always been kind of a rural phenomenon where you find pigs are in rural areas, not in cities?
Yeah, of course. You in a city, because Taiwan witnessed a rapid industrialization and urbanization since 1960 and 1970s. Of course, during that time, you could see a lot of animals in urban area because, particularly in the margins of cities, you can see still there are so many farmers and farming parties in the margin of cities. However, nowadays, because Taiwanese urban area has developed into a very, very industrialized city. So nowadays, it's so difficult for you to see animals in the urban area. So if you want to see pig, geese, and a duck, you need to go to the countryside. So that's the another problem, because now the Taiwanese government imposed very strict biosecurity measures for farmers who keeping animals. So it literally means that you need to hire some biosecurity consultant company to help you to develop all biosecurity measures. Otherwise, you cannot keep animal in the Taiwanese countryside. So it's quite different.
Even if you are not selling the animals, so if you are just keeping an animal for subsistence or for yourself, do you still have to hire a company, or is this something you have to do if you are industrializing or creating a bigger farm?
Oh, if you just keep one or two animal, that's fine. But if you want to sell an animal, the government require you to hire someone. You need to have all biosecurity measures in practice. Otherwise, you cannot keep or sell an animal in your house. That's the government regulation.
Great. We're going to talk more about this, I think, during the episode today. But before we get too deep into that, I wanted to ask a couple more questions about you. So you said now that you grew up in Taiwan and you became interested in this based on kind of your personal relationships and observations with regards to farms and how you could go onto them. But in your professional life, how did you start to get interested in kind of like food geographies and animal geographies? What was your journey?
Actually, I obtained my PhD degree from the UK, Upper Swiss University. Initially, my PhD thesis is just about rural development, especially particularly focused on community development. For example, how rural community develop a self-help, initiate, try to boost local economy. After graduation, finishing my PhD degree, working in a university, now I'm working in National Taiwan University. I found that it's quite interesting because I love animal, of course. And as I mentioned, my family and all my relatives still live in the Taiwanese countryside. I'm the only one working in the urban area. So it means that I have much time to visit my land. So every time I travel back to the countryside, I see the animal farm become quite different. I cannot recognize this kind of a farm. So I think, wow, the way people treating animal become so different. So I developed my research interest. Since 2017, before COVID-19 pandemic, I submit a research proposal to my government, asking them for grant. I want to research animal farm in the Taiwanese countryside. I just want to know what's going on, what happened to this animal, why the way we're treating them becomes so different. Yeah, especially for the economic animals. Of course, in the broader animal studies, there are so different areas. For example, people may get interested in conservation or domestic animal and so on. But I'm just curious about economic animal.
So you're kind of interested in how the economics or the economies around pigs have changed over time. Taiwan is a really interesting case study. And I think in your paper, you spoke about Taiwan and you also mentioned some really fascinating details about Japan. And you spoke a little bit about kind of the meatification of these countries. And I think there you were speaking in particular about Japan. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about these big changes as you've understood them from trying to understand the economic changes. What are these economic changes that you've seen happen in what's a relatively short period of time?
I think the concept of meatification is developed by a rural sociologist, Frederick McMichael. In his observation, Second World War II, not so many Japanese people consume meat, and especially in Eastern Asia, for example, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Japan, including China. China nowadays become the biggest meat consumption country in the world, and the second one, I think, is Japan. All of these Eastern Asia countries, they did not eat so much meat before the Second World War II. However, after the Second World War II, especially in Japan and Taiwan, with the aid and the help of United States, they sent a lot of consultants to Japan and Taiwan and try to educate, for example, Taiwanese people, oh, you need to eat more healthy. Now, the concept of eating more healthy means that you need to consume more meat. Okay? So the Taiwanese government, they developed a collaboration with the United States Army. So they conduct a lot of scientific experience in Taiwan, try to educate or teach Taiwanese people what it means for healthy food. Okay? And during the time, healthy means eat more meat. This case, you can also observe in Japan. During, I think, before 19th centuries, the Japanese people, they also did not eat so much meat. Especially, you can show the Japanese emperor actually just want to show before 19th century, eating meat was tabooed in Japan because they are Buddhism. No killing is the main principle of Buddhism. So it literally means that you cannot kill animal for consumption. But the Japanese government completely changed their diet because of the Western style scientific dietary become so powerful in Japan. So after the Second World War II, like Taiwan, with aid and help of the expert, especially dietary expert from the United States, they always teach in Eastern Asia countries that you need to eat more meat for your health. Yeah, that's the problem.
Wow, this is so interesting because I mean, so there was one statistic you had in your paper which I just thought was so fascinating. You said in 1872, the Japanese emperor was the first person he broke in essence the taboo on eating beef. I think it said there had been a 1,200 year ban on eating beef, which was just a startling kind of historical thing to grapple with, and then. Just with what you're thinking now, the role of scientists and the role of dietary kind of professionals and supposed experts in shaping the world, is quite interesting because I think we've kind of been sold this idea. There's kind of a stereotype in a lot of people's minds that, particularly around dairy, I think that, you know, Asian populations don't eat dairy. Asian populations don't have a history of eating large quantities of meat. And then as you've said, you're seeing a big change now, particularly with regards to China. China is home to some of the biggest factory farms in the world. And people aren't quite understanding. And a lot of folks, I think, say, oh, this is maybe an aspirational thing to Western diets. But what I hear you saying here now is it's not just aspirational. This was an active campaign on Western countries coming into Asian countries and saying, this is what you should do. It wasn't just an organic. Is that a correct assessment, that this was actually an active campaign by some Western countries like the US to change the ways in which Asian countries operate?
Absolutely, especially for the United States. After the Second World War II, because the United States produced a huge lot of crops. However, it exists the domestic consumption. So the United States, they just want to find a foreign market for their domestic crop. So the best way is to find its military allies. It literally means Japan and Taiwan after the Second World War II. So for some academic scholars, they said, because the United States want to turn Taiwan become the meat industry manufacturer in the world. So first of all, they send a lot of dietary consultants to Taiwan to educating people to consume more meat. Secondly, they export a huge quantity of crop to Taiwan because Taiwan, we don't raising pig in industrial way. Literally means that you need to have a lot of fed stuff. Taiwan don't have this kind of fed stuff. It literally means that you need to import this fed stuff and the antibiotics from the United States. So the Taiwanese government developed collaboration with the United States and complete a change, gradually change Taiwanese pig farmer to become from smallholder to commercial and industrial pig farmer since 1960. So Taiwan, since then, Taiwan become from 1990s to 1996, before foot and mouth disease outbreak, Taiwan was the world's biggest pork exporter in the world.
Well, I had no idea. I mean, I've known about like Argentina with regards to beef, and I think we often kind of focus on beef and the politics of beef because of its relationship with deforestation and climate change in what's a very obvious way. But of course, pig production has kind of, you know, exploded in the last 10 or 20 years. And, you know, what's really fascinating about what you're speaking about here, and this is a bit about one of the concepts that we're focusing on today, the global agri-food production, is so often we focus on meat, but meat is just one step. And I mean, so animals and meat is not, you know, animals are killed for meat to come. And that's a really important part of this process. But what you're talking about here is how an entire market and commodity chain was created, not necessarily for the sale of meat, but for the sale of, what did you mention? You said like grain, oilseed, soy, so that the US could sell these to other folks. So they needed to create a market in other places. That's really interesting. So what are some of the other connections? If we're talking about a global agri-food production network, so we're speaking about the animals, kind of the process of making them into meat, soy, and are these the kind of international connections you're talking about?
Yeah, for example, as you can mention, after COVID-19 pandemic, there is a shortage economy around the world. So people in Western countries, they cannot buy a lot of stuff from Eastern Asia countries, which are the biggest manufacturer in the world. So nowadays, we have this kind of international division of labor. Eastern Asia country become every manufacturer or a factory of everything, including meat. And the Western country become the biggest consumer our biggest market in the world. So now we need Eastern Asia country, for example, China and Japan and Taiwan. We need to import a lot of this stuff and from Western country, for example, United States, Brazil, Argentina, to feed animal in our home country. And after domestication and pig become bigger, and now we can export this meat back to Western country or Japan. So now we need to, if you want to know the way how people treating animal, we need to trace this global commodity chain in order to understand how industrial farming become so popular in this country. So you cannot just focus on single country to grasp or to better understand the way people treating animal. So it is a global phenomena. We need to develop more interesting to trace, to follow how this pig industry came into being in this way.
Yeah, definitely need to follow the global connections. And I think when we start to speak about biosecurity and questions of pathogens, this kind of global movement of animals, of commodities, and of diseases becomes quite interesting as well, because it's not just, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not just the crops that are being traded, but live animals are being traded as well in order to kind of sustain population dynamics, right? And you've got different kind of pathogens and drugs as well. You mentioned antibiotics. Could you tell us a little bit about that? So when you talk about antibiotics and animals in this kind of global agri-food industry, what role do antibiotics play?
I think antibiotics become part of a biosecurity major. Now, because you want to raise a lot of animals in a small room, for example, in Taiwan, normally you can, if you visit a pig farm, you can find almost 5,000 pigs in very, very small pig farm. So it's a very, very intense and a very industrial farming practice. So it means you need to keep animal or this prevent this animal from the incursion of pathogen. For example, you need to build a lot of biosecurity measure, and you need to use a lot of antibiotic drug to prevent the invasion of pathogen. For example, there are so many animal disease coming from the outside for this industrial farming. And in my paper, I just want to argue against this kind of a biosecurity measure, because it normally the threat not coming from the outside. Normally, because you practice industrial farming, so that's the reason why disease outbreak. You cannot no longer prevent or to keep animal healthy by using biosecurity practice. Especially, for example, an evolution biologist, Rob Wallace, he wrote a book, A Big Farm Creates Big Flu. So there are so many animals living together. It means that we create a perfect disease situation for new emerging disease to outbreak. So, for example, you can find a lot of novel swine flu developing in industrial pig farm, rather than coming from the outside pig farm. So this kind of biosecurity measure for me, it cannot keep animal from or prevent animal from the incursion of pasture. Instead, it create a lot of the perfect disease situation.
Yeah, it creates perfect opportunities, because I guess the pathogens just have multiple bodies to jump between, to practice, to learn. And yeah, this reminds me of Steve Hinchliffe just speaking about the idea that you can somehow keep the disease, that somehow the threat is outside, when in actual fact you're creating a perfect storm for the creation or the manifestation of diseases from the inside. Really interesting. So this is kind of where you start to speak, I think, a bit in your paper about the idea of politics of domestication. So we've got this global agri-food industry where we've got kind of animals, meat, pathogens, medicines kind of passing between all these different countries. That passing is political, it's historical, but this is all part of what you kind of argue is a broader politics of domestication. Could you tell us a little bit about that? What do you mean when you say politics of domestication?
The idea of politics of domestication I developed in the paper actually is an attempt to understand how Western farming practices, in particular concentrated animal feeding operation, aka CAFO, C-A-F-O, become the dominant and powerful domestication practice around the world. In Taiwan, for example, after the foot and mouth disease outbreak in 1997, CAFO and biosecurity have become the dominant and powerful domestication narrative. So the government made all biosecurity mandatory for all animal farms. So it actually has two major impacts on indigenous farming practices. First, it renders traditional domestication practices marginalized and invisible, with CAFO's emphasis on modern science and technology. Traditional domestication practices are considered as backward, paving the way for novel animal disease outbreak. In this context, a tension arose as farmers practicing traditional domestication so to redeem their reputation. They just want to say, we are not backward, we just want to keep animal in this way. So for example, in Taiwan, there was many farms raising so-called black pigs, an indigenous pig with a mixed genetic background. Black pigs, which are traditional feed with catering waste or pig swell, have a higher market value in Taiwan. To deal with the threat of African swine fever or foot and mouth disease, a cable farm in Taiwan, especially in the southern Taiwan, most of them practicing very, very strict biosecurity and claim that feeding pigs with pig swine or catering waste from kitchen should be made illegal in Taiwan, because they think it may create a loophole for new pasturing to come to Taiwan.
Sorry, before you go on, so just so I understand correctly, so the traditional practices, you had black pigs who were kind of indigenous pigs, and the traditional practices of keeping pigs were to feed them pig swill. And pig swill is kind of like leftover vegetables, leftover food stuff, and it's just kind of made into a mash of sorts. Is that what pig swill is?
Yeah. Especially, for example, a sociologist, a British sociologist, John Lowe, he also wrote a paper. In the paper, he observed feeding pigs with pigs swill as collecting from urban kitchen. Okay, so it actually creates a very perfect circular economy for humankind, because you have a lot of people consuming food in urban area. So now there are so many pig farmers. They collect pigs well in this urban kitchen and they collect and feed in their pigs. It is a very, very good circular economy. But now almost in European country and Australia, New Zealand, most of these countries, they completely ban feeding pig with pig swill because of biosecurity concern. Okay, so now these black pig farms in Taiwan were by no means a small scale operation, but they practicing this some kind of circular economy in Taiwan.
And this is still happening in like 1996. This is still happening in Taiwan.
Yeah, now there are some black pig farmers still operating their business in the northern Taiwan. Okay, I will talk about it later. So for now, for cable farm, pig swill, which had not been processed properly, may contain harmful virus that could cause FMD or foot and mouth disease or African swine fever. So, however, a black pig farmer, they completely oppose such claim. So they organize a campaign fighting against this narrative developed by cattle farmers. So they argue that one cannot rule out the possibility that manufactured animal feed may also be contaminated with dangerous microbes. For example, new pasturing, especially for this black pig farmer, they are highly educated. They also Google and they find so many scientific papers suggesting that the possibility that manufactured animal feed, for example, crab, something like that, may also be contaminated and become a loophole of dangerous microbes, for example, African swine flu, fever. So as you can see, traditional pig farmer and cattle farmer, they are fighting with each other in Taiwan. And nowadays, they are still fighting with each other because they operate in completely different way. Yeah, that's the notion I call about it as a domestication politics.
So CAFOs, I'm aware of CAFOs, and I think CAFOs are often what we kind of see when we see these, you know, many of these horrible videos on social media about how animals are treated, like the animals just jam-packed into particular really small confinement, fed a very standardized diet. This is factory farming. Now, I understand that black pigs are fed something like pig swill, which is a different diet. Are there different practices in the farms as well, or are they also quite intensive?
Now in Taiwan, because of the biosecurity concern and the fighting between CAFO farmer and black pig farmer, so this black pig farmer they just want to showcase. They also practice very very strict biosecurity. So now they become much more similar with CAFO or farmer, because the government always said, "Wow, now because you are feeding your pigs with pig swill, so you need to buy some equipment to boil this pig swill to ensure you follow the strict guideline of biosecurity." So now this black pig farmer, they become so many, they become just like their counterparts, CAFO pig farming, especially in Taiwan nowadays. However, over 15 years ago or 40 years ago, the pig farmer, because it required more time to raise black pig, almost double time. For CAFO, white pigs only takes many, just 8 months or 10 months to raise a white pig. However, for black pigs, it may be takes much longer. For example, maybe 16 or 18 months for raise a black pig. So during that time, 30 or 40 years ago, they require a huge space for black pig. But nowadays, they become much smaller and much more just like a factory farming in Taiwan.
So biosecurity measures were imported primarily with kind of these white pigs in mind and the ways in which they've been operated. But because of economic pressures and also because of, I think, biosecurity, that these folks that have been farming black pigs have now also started to co-opt biosecurity measures. So they've got more intensive farming operations, more pigs, smaller situations. So this is to your point that the more biosecurity is kind of imposed on farmers, the more intensive these situations are going to get. But are there instances where farmers were doing this kind of intensity or intensive kind of farming before these biosecurity measures?
For me, the biosecurity measure actually started in the 1960s when the United States tried to transform Taiwan into a global meat factory. Since 1960. And for example, most smallholders, they do not feed pig with antibiotic. However, United States, they teach smallholders how to use antibiotic in Taiwan. So they even, the Taiwanese government, even they create, establish an antibiotic company with the United States government in Taiwan. So, yeah, so during that time, I think since the use of antibiotics in pig farming in Taiwan, I think that's the beginning of capitalism in Taiwan. However, Taiwan became the biggest pork exporter since 1960. Since then, you can see a lot of big pig farming in Taiwan. And pig farming means more biosecurity. So biosecurity is not just come out of blue, it's gradually accumulate in Taiwan. The use of antibiotics, now you can see you need to wear personal protective equipment before entering a pig farm. So it's not just suddenly transform all the Taiwanese pig farming. It's gradually transform Taiwan into a K4 or the world's animal meat factory. So biosecurity is a gradually a major, yeah. But after 1997, the Taiwanese government imposed more and more biosecurity major.
So there's been this constant, so there was big farming, there was massive farming, but then these biosecurity measures, it's not necessarily about the scale, but it's changed how farming has functioned in the country. A conversation that's not being had enough is talking about antimicrobial resistance, right? That this, a lot of people at the World Health Organization are now saying like, this is going to be the next, it's like the silent killer right now, where tons of people are dying actually because they're resistant to drugs, because drugs, I think it's something like 80% or over 80% of the world's antibiotics are currently being used on animals like pigs and cows, livestock animals, which is just, you know, I find it absolutely terrifying. The idea that we could have a future where penicillin doesn't work is just really, really scary.
Yeah, it creates a lot of concern for the Taiwanese people, but especially antibiotic resistance. I think it's the biggest problem for all humankind. We need to face this problem. Otherwise, it will become more and more serious. For example, for new or novel emerging disease. Okay, now because we use a lot of antibiotics in animal and in our human body. If you just catch a cold, you went to a doctor and they just prescribed antibiotic for you. So this is not a good way to deal with microbes in the world. We need to find a new way to live or to coexist with microbes. Yeah, otherwise we will witness more dangerous emerging disease outbreak.
And have fewer tools to combat them with. So what do you have any thoughts on? So you've done a lot of looking at how biosecurity has changed in the country. Do you have any thoughts about where you think it should go with regards to pigs and biosecurity?
Now, as I mentioned, because the conflict between black farmer and the capital farmer, now the biosecurity issue become quite sensitive in Taiwan, especially for the majority of Taiwanese people. They believe For the sake of the Taiwanese pig industry, we need to have more biosecurity. Otherwise, we cannot have a very strong or powerful pork industry or meat industry in Taiwan. To be honest, most Taiwanese people believe we need to do this way. However, for me, actually, we need to reduce meat consumption. It's the best way to deal with the problem. Otherwise, it just turned Taiwan become a very, very perfect pig disease situation. For example, last year, there is a novel, the first confirmed case of pig swine flu, jumping from a pig to a 5 years old girl. It's the first confirmed case report in Taiwan, but people, they don't pay much attention to this case, but it's quite dangerous. If you cannot identify this disease, a zoonotic disease, in the first place, it will create another pandemic. So I think this is the real problem. We need to reduce meat consumption. or to reduce our pig farming. Otherwise, we cannot reduce more the use of antibiotics, the more biosecurity. Yeah, this is my concept. Now, as you can see, China, since 1990s, it became the world's biggest market for pig meat. So this meatization become a huge problem for all humanity and for humankind. We need to face this problem. How so many people consume so many animal products in the world? We need to rethink this question and this problem.
I don't think I could say it any better. It is concerning. And as more and more, coming back to your idea of the politics of domestication, though, like I'm 100%, I mean, I think we should stop eating meat. I think meat is the center of many, you know, CAFOs are the center of many, many problems with regards to disease, with regards to workers' rights, with regards to animals and how they're treated. But coming back to your idea of the politics of domestication, I think, you know, the increased consumption of meat in Asia presents kind of an interesting case because, you know, it's one thing for Asian, you know, for Western countries now to say, oh, you know, to point their fingers at the world and say, oh, listen, we need to reduce our consumption, when in actual fact, it's the consumption of Western countries and the development of these CAFOs in the first place that got us here. And, you know, it can often look kind of hypocritical that just at the moment when Asian countries are starting to do a variety of practices that have become equated with progress, with modernization, that Western countries and Western scholars turn and say, hey, listen, that's not okay. You can't do that anymore. And I can just assume that it is so unbelievably frustrating. You know, we have it in South Africa as well. In Botswana, there was a case not too long ago where Botswana kind of got a bit angry because people were getting frustrated with kind of the killing of wildlife, rightfully so. But at some point, Botswana said, you can't treat Botswana as the country where you get to say political things about what we do with our animals when you're the ones that came over here and killed them in the first place. Do you have any kind of thoughts on that, kind of the politics of, I agree, it's a big concern as meat consumption increases in China. It's a big concern and we should definitely be talking about it. But how do we talk about that at the same time as realizing that, you know, Western countries and their practices are what got us here in the first place?
Yeah, definitely, especially in the international scale. I think most Western countries bear the responsibility to reduce meat consumption. But you need to better understand why these developing countries, they want, most people in this country, why they want to eat so many meat. Because meat consumption stands for more civilized world. It stands for more wealthy country. So, for example, in China, eating meat during Chinese New Year, it means, wow, your family must be quite wealthy and better off. So it becomes a symbol of a civilization. We need to, I think for most developing countries, we need to decolonize this kind of thought. It does not mean that you eat a lot of meat, it means you become more civilized. So we need to deconstruct the connection between this kind of thought. Otherwise, we cannot see any opportunity to reduce meat consumption in the future. Especially in China, eating meat especially pork consumption, become a very, very political issue. For example, even in China, as you can see, so many African swine fever case in China. However, the country need to ensure to guarantee the provision of pork during the Chinese New Year. Otherwise, you will create a political turmoil in China. So the best way to deal with this is to break away eating meat, literally means more civilized or more progress way.
Yes, the decolonize, that kind of coupling of meat consumption and civilization. I think that's a really, really important point. Because we need to kind of create new ideas of what we want to become and what it means to be human and what it means to be, you know, in thinking about the world we want tomorrow.
Yeah, especially as I mentioned, before 19th century, not so many Japanese people consume meat or pork. So we need to find our root. For example, in Taiwan, because there are so many Buddhist believers in Taiwan who also did not consume any meat, including pork or beef, something like that. So not indigenous knowledge is not bad for us. So it's not just Western scientific thought. It's good for this developing country. Yeah, so we need to, as you mentioned, we need to decouple the notion between civilization and wealthy country. If you become wealthy, it does not mean you need to consume more meat.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think also even the idea of it somehow being scientific now is completely being disrupted, right, by the rising rates of heart disease. By, I think increasingly there are studies from scholars saying you can actually see the kind of correlation with the increase in meat consumption in Asia with the increase in heart disease. And that the correlation is staggering when you start to say, well, people were onto something with a kind of primarily plant-based diet. We function better as humans. So I know we've been speaking for a little while. Before we go to the quotes, I just wanted to ask you one quick question. So I've been seeing a lot in the news about African swine fever, and it seems like it's a really big issue at the moment. So because we're speaking about pigs now, could you maybe just tell me a little bit about what is African swine fever, and what does it do? Like, what does it mean for pigs if they get this disease?
Okay, ASF, African swine fever, is a very, very deadly disease for pig, also known as the cancer of pig. So it's a DNA disease. Nowadays, we still have no vaccine for African swine fever. So it poses a very, very threat for all pig farming in Eastern Asia, especially in Taiwan and in China. So both governments, the Chinese government and the Taiwanese government, they impose a very, very strict biosecurity measure, border control, try to prevent the incursion or invasion of ASF.
But what is the disease itself? Is it like is it a respiratory disease? Is it a skin disease?
It's a fever. So if pig contract with ASF, it develops symptoms, a blooding fever, and a pig will suddenly pass away if you contract with the disease.
So it's a very quick disease. And how does it spread between pigs?
Actually, the virus can contain in the meat or frozen meat, and it can survive in the frozen meat for a long time. So in Taiwan, for example, the Taiwanese government imposed for travelers who travel from China to Taiwan, if the traveler bring frozen meat from China, no matter what kind of meat product, they impose a very, very serious biosecurity concern. So it can contaminate in frozen animal products. And if you visit a pig farm, which were contaminated with ASF, and the virus can survive in the human's nose, mouth, and hair. So if you visit a pig farm and you in China and you go back to Taiwan, within 7 days, if you visit any farm, it also could create a pandemic.
Wow, okay. So it's a very adaptable virus. And this is why when you visited the farms now during your research, you had to wear all of this PPE?
Indeed. That's the reason. All Taiwanese governments require all visitors, if you want to visit a pig farm, you need to wear this kind of product. And especially those careful farmers, they will ask me, if you ask if you visit any pig farm in China or other pig farm in Taiwan within 7 days to ensure my body is pathogen free.
Wow, okay. So there's a lot of surveillance to just make sure that anyone who's moving into the farm is disease-free, in quotation marks. Okay, this has been really interesting. Thank you so much. I've definitely learned a lot about kind of Taiwan, also about some of these like global connections and how they're shaped by history. And I've got to say, I love what you were saying about this kind of separating the idea of meat eating from what it means to be civilized or what a country's identity should be centered on. I think that's a really important point. So we're approaching the quote portion of the show. I give folks an opportunity to read a quote with something that they want to convey. Do you have a quote ready?
Thank you so much, Claudia. Yeah, I would like to cite a quote by anthropology Heather N. Swanson and Marianne Lane in their work, the book entitled Domesticating Gone Wild. In the book, they say, through ethnographical attention to domestication assemblage that are marginalized, we can show how multi-species relations become implicated in context of colonial expansion, in the making of resource frontier, and in other effort associated progress. So we need to pay more attention to those practices who are marginalized by Western scientific farming practices.
That's a really great quote, and I think that speaks to so much that you've said in today's interview, right? We need to pay attention to animals who are marginalized. We need to pay attention to indigenous practices that are marginalized. We need to pay attention to kind of historical practices that have been invisibilized as well. What inspired you to choose that quote?
I think the reason why I developed an interest in becoming animal is because I read their book. And the book, the title is quite good, because now all domestication gone wild. So many domestication become so huge, so industrialized. That's create a lot of problem for all humankind we need to deal with in the future. Yeah, so I really like the title of the book.
Yeah, and it's not just problems for humankind, right? Of course, these are creating problems now for all sorts of animals, all sorts of, like you said, these pathogens jump from inside outside now, not from outside in. So it's creating all sorts of problems for humans and for many other animals and environments. Before you go, could you tell us what you're working on now, and if people want to get in touch with you, how they can get in touch?
Thank you. I'm currently working on a research project which deals with plant disease, another disease, okay? And you can find out more of my work through my personal website or Twitter. I'm very happy to discuss my work with you and very sure that I can benefit from our discussion. Thank you.
And I'm sure people will benefit from the discussion with you. It's been fantastic having you on the show and just learning a bit about your work and your paper. I'll pop it in the show notes for people. And I'll also make sure I include your Twitter handle and website. Thank you so much for joining me on The Animal Turn.
Thank you, Claudia, for your invitation.
Hi, Mandy.
Hi.
Just like that, we are on the 7th Animal Highlight, which is rather remarkable. So the season is going full steam ahead. Who are we going to be talking about today?
Today, we're going to talk about salmon.
Great. I don't think we've had any fish yet in this season, right?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, I guess just to give a little bit of a plug for fish and the book by Jonathan Balcom, What a Fish Knows, is where I'm getting a lot of this knowledge of fishes from. So salmon are increasingly being farmed in aquaculture operations. And salmon who escape from these farms are often painted as biosecurity threats, contaminating the purity of wild salmon who they mate with. For example, I found a 2021 New Scientist article that expressed concern over, quote, genetic contamination as wild fish breed with escapees from fish farms. And these dominant discourses that treat escapee salmon as infectious agents really deny that their lives matter, and they overlook the exploitative circumstances from which these fishes are acting to liberate themselves. Jonathan Balcom explains that aquaculture works on the same principles as factory farming land animals, so fish are confined to these marine or freshwater pens or sometimes land-based tanks in shocking densities. So just to give you an example, in trout farms, there can be as many as 27 fishes who are each a foot long per bathtub volume of water. Like, a bathtub, I feel, doesn't fit me, let alone 27 fishes. The dense confinement of salmon is intensely stressful for them, but it also creates the perfect environment for things like sea lice to thrive. Balcombe describes nightmarish conditions in which sea lice chew through the mucus, eyes, and flesh of salmon who aren't able to escape. And these conditions also give rise to brutal viral and bacterial diseases, and again, it's the salmon who suffer. It's generally considered acceptable in this industry for 10 to 30% of farmed fishes to die before they even reach slaughter. And of course, 100% of them eventually die when they're killed. More layers to the suffering and distress of farmed salmon really become apparent when you start to compare their stationary and high-density confinement with the free and richly migratory lives of wild salmon. For example, Atlantic salmon have ranges of over 9,000 kilometers. And though there are exceptions, salmon are typically what we call anadromous, which essentially means that they hatch in freshwater streams, then migrate downstream to the saltwater ocean where they spend several years, and then they migrate back upstream to their natal homes to spawn. And of course, there's also salmon who migrate to large bodies of fresh water instead of the salty oceans. And the migratory journey of salmon requires unbelievable navigational skills, mind-boggling physical feats, and just incredible adaptability. Salmon navigate using multiple complementary methods, as far as we know. One of these is geomagnetic sensing. So magnetic particles are actually part of salmon's cellular makeup and help them to sense and respond to the Earth's magnetic field. And I'm just so mesmerized and taken by the idea that salmon can feel the pull of the Earth in every cell of their being. Salmon also rely on incredible senses of smell. So Balcombe discusses how some salmon can detect the smell of sea lions, who are a predator, at a concentration that's equivalent to 2/3 of a drop in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So just incredible smell sensitivity. When young salmon migrate from the place where they hatch to the ocean, or in some cases to a large freshwater body, they sense and remember the water chemistry of their route, and then this absolutely astounds me. Years later, they're able to travel upstream, return to their natal home, by following that odor trail in reverse. It's so cool.
Oh, so they're following the odor trail. So they've memorized the same way as we would memorize like landmarks. So if I'm going to this place, oh, there's a tree at the corner of this road. They've memorized the smellscape of their route, and then they're retracing their steps backwards. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure of the like exact mechanics of how this all works, but I think that's essentially what happens. In addition to geomagnetic sensing and smell, they also may rely on things like the sun, their vision, or social dynamics to help navigate. So it's just a really complex and incredible series of abilities and attunements that they deploy. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the salmon's journey doesn't only require superb navigational skills, it requires Olympian levels of endurance and strength, particularly when they travel upstream back to their spawning grounds. So they have these streamlined and muscular bodies that help them to travel long distances and to swim against the current. And not only are they traveling against the current, which sounds exhausting, they must also often evade predators, for example, grizzly bears or human fishers. And one of the most show-stopping parts of their journey is when they have to leap up waterfalls. I can't even. And just to give you a little taste of how remarkable this is, if you haven't seen it, I remember watching salmon travel up the Humber River last year. And even though there aren't full-fledged waterfalls here, just smaller cascades of water, I still felt like I was at the most high-stakes sporting event ever. And I would just be holding my breath as you'd see salmon attempting to make that jump up a cascade of water. And couldn't help but cheer when they finally make that impossible leap. It was just such a triumphant moment. Wild salmon experience incredible change throughout their lives. So their skin will change color depending on genetic factors, hormonal shifts, or changing camouflage needs. I think one of the most beautiful transformations happens when sockeye salmon, who are blue with black speckles and a white belly while in the ocean, transform into these vibrant red fishes with these olive green heads once they move to freshwater to spawn. Salmon, in addition, can adjust their biochemistry to help them live between fresh and saltwater environments. They can adapt their bodies and behaviors and adjust to everything from large bodies of water that are rich in food, but also predators, to turbulent tidal coasts, and even swift-flowing rocky rivers. They're just incredibly versatile beings. So to close, I just want to reiterate, salmon are incredible, but the astonishing sensory and navigational and physical and adaptive powers of these migratory beings can't be exercised at all in the confined and unchanging environment of fish farms. They can't fully inhabit their bodies. They can't follow these desires that pull them to migrate back to their birthplaces. They can't experience freedom of choice. They can't enjoy diverse foods or ecosystems. And yet, even in these really disabling and exploitative conditions, salmon do find ways to resist and express their dissent, or, returning to where we began, in the case of escapee salmon, they can even liberate themselves.
Thanks so much. And, you know, in speaking to Chima about, you know, the politics of domestication, I think it's easy to focus on some animals, rightfully so, you know, cows, chickens, pigs, but sometimes fish and fishes are kind of obscured in these conversations. It's easy to think, oh, they're just being caught. And this is also to kind of, even if they are wild caught, right? The number of challenges and issues that come with wild catching in terms of the fishing nets are the most abundant plastic in the ocean, right? This is a serious kind of effect. And, you know, you spoke about how these diseases impact the lives of the salmon who are caught up in these containers. It also spreads through these containers because these massive vats where fish are contained are often housed in ocean and shorefronts, right? Where other fishes come nearby, bacteria and viruses and pathogens have different agendas, and they're not sticking to farms and they're not sticking to walls, which I think, you know, Steve Hinchliffe really, really highlighted beautifully in episode one of The Animal Turn. This is all just to say that I think really thinking about what it means, you know, there's domestication and then there's, you know, the kind of farming practices that we have today and what this means, not only for the animals involved in those practices, but also for the numerous animals that these practices impact beyond those boundaries. And as an aside, speaking about colors and something that just, I had no idea, right? I used to eat salmon. I don't anymore. I don't eat any animals, but I used to love salmon, really. You know, the pink flesh. I was like, oh, this is great. And I only learned recently that a lot of what we associate with being that like pink color of salmon from farmed salmon is actually dyed. It's put in there as a marketing ploy so that you think, you know, it's healthy. But really, these animals, they are so deprived of their nutrients, of what they want, of their will and what they need, that their skin on the inside has actually gone this like dull gray color, their flesh. It looks sickly, which is maybe not surprising. Anyways, animal highlight. I don't want to bring it down in a gloom. Salmon are amazing, and I really appreciate what you said about them doing these kind of incredible feats. You know, imagine if we started speaking about just the amazing, I think it's Mark Bekoff said that if any of us could do half the things that other animals could do, we would think we were superheroes, right? Like we create all these superhero films, but you've got animals that are leaping up waterfalls. Alrighty, thank you so much again. I look forward to talking to you in the next one. Thank you to Chima for joining me on the show, to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast, to the Biosecurities and Urban Governance Research Collective for sponsoring the season, Gordon Clark for the bed music, Jeremy John for the logo, Christian Mintz for his editing work, and Amanda Munton-Wahlberg for the animal highlight. My list of thank yous are getting bigger and bigger. It's great. If you haven't already, please go and check out the YouTube channel for The Animal Turn. I've started making little videos. They are still rudimentary, but things are getting there and we're making big changes. Anyway, if you're still here and listening, we're happy to have you, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Huttenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.